This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This episode is just podcast family. I'm here with Annie to talk all things growing up, something that at times both of us very much need to do.
We could consider it, yes.
Yeah, we'll pick up some tips in this episode.
For sure.
From ourselves. So the episode will all be about growing up and what that experience was like in terms of us and our mental health. And we'll also get into how that can be a factor in the mental health of so many.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, we've got a few stats to start off with. First of all, from mentalhealth.org, they found 20% of adolescents may experience a mental health problem in any given year. They also found 50% of mental health problems are established by age 14 and 75% by age 24. Any initial thoughts on those?
That's really sad.
Mm.
We've mentioned these stats before, haven't we, in our petition?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So sad.
I think these stats are particularly useful. With the first one, the fact that they're saying 20% of adolescents may experience a mental health problem in a given year, that's very similar to the one from Mind, that one in four people will experience a mental health condition this year.
Except that's one in five, right? Because that's 20% going into 100 five times.
Yeah, so this is one in five, they're saying, for adolescents. But what's interesting is how close that is to the amount in adults.
Yeah.
And actually, I think a lot of people don't realise that it's only 5% less common.
Mm. That's good maths. I'm impressed. My maths was never that good. The fact that I managed to divide 100 by 20 was impressive to me just then. So I was still riding that wave until you came in with your 5%. Yeah, I think that's super interesting. I mean, is it more beneficial that things are diagnosed earlier on? Yes, that there tends to be more positive long-term effects if the condition's caught early.
Absolutely. The sooner people can get the support, the better. Mm. And we've spoken to so many guests already where they've had an experience of going through a prolonged period of time without a diagnosis or with the wrong one.
Sure.
And how much that's impacted their recovery.
Or they've even done sort of acts of self-care and they've said, I don't know why I wasn't doing this sooner.
For sure.
Yeah.
And that's something I can definitely relate to, is that if I had been diagnosed sooner, I definitely would have started working on it sooner.
For sure.
Particularly with certain conditions, part of the symptoms and how they manifest can be denial and hiding it from yourself and others.
Mm.
And so actually getting a diagnosis is potentially a way to interrupt that. I know that was certainly a factor with me when I had my eating disorder diagnosis, that it really brought it out of the dark and I had to face up to it and be like, okay, now I have to do something about it.
Sure.
Now that I know it's there and I've properly acknowledged it.
Yeah.
But what's worth noting, particularly with that stat, the second one that you've referenced, it's saying that the mental health problems are established, so the symptoms or the condition are started by these ages.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily that they've been diagnosed at that point.
Oh, wow.
So it's a tricky stat for them to establish, really, because they've had to find out, trace back where people's symptoms began.
Yeah.
But I'd say potentially the stats may be even higher because there'll be people that won't realise. And if their memory is anything as shit as mine, they probably won't remember it anyway.
Sure. I know that it's really common for people with particular mental health problems as well. Loss of memory is really common. So in things like dissociative identity disorder, I know that because of those different identities within you, you do actually have a huge problem in remembering. And it seems like a recurring thread that's running through early stages of mental health disorder or problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever. I don't know. What do you feel like mental health issues, problems, disorders? Like, what term do we use?
It's appropriateness, isn't it? The term I use most is mental health because that's what we're striving for.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to support here with the podcast.
Sure.
But if it's the flip side of illnesses, I'll generally say mental illness because I feel like out of the terms, that one seems to have the most stigma attached to it.
Yeah, sure.
Partly because of the word illness. Yeah. Or I'll say mental health condition.
Oh, yeah.
They're quite interchangeable, those two.
That's true. I think it depends on the context of the person that you're talking about and how they consider it, because I could often refer to my anxiety and depression as a mental health disorder, because it is a disorder of my health. I wouldn't necessarily refer to it as an illness, really. I don't know. It's a tricky one, isn't it? I suppose it's personal preference, really.
I think that's true, and the connotations we have to these words can be subjective. So some people may view an illness as something more temporary and something that you can recover from.
Sure.
Whereas there are some conditions that turn out to be lifelong.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe then condition is a more appropriate word.
Yeah.
I literally switched terms there without even realising I'd do it. So
for sure. Interesting. Sorry, a bit of a tangent, but just as I was coming up, I was like, oh, actually.
But the language is super important.
True.
And so to bring it back round, a final stat I wanted to include here was from The Guardian. They found that less than 30% of mental health research is focused on young people.
What?
So that one particularly shocks me, given the stats we've just gone through. And I think is a part of the greater problem that people don't realise how young mental illness can start.
Yeah.
And how young, therefore, we need the support.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I read something today, actually, that was like about how there's this sort of shame in parents if they don't live with a mental health condition themselves. There can be a lot of shame around the potential of their child having a mental health condition, because to them it feels like a failure of their parenting, and they don't realise that it's not a direct fault of theirs, which is something that my mother, I definitely think, could learn from. But they don't realise that sometimes that's just the way it is. You know, you're just born with it in the same way that you're born with other conditions. So I think it's super important to highlight the fact that there's a lot of ignorance around young people and their mental health condition, because they're not in control of their health. I mean, you're a minor in the eyes of your doctor until you're 18, right?
Yes.
And I know there are sort of confidentiality laws around, they don't have to tell your parents about contraception and that sort of stuff, or counselling. But I just think there's so much ignorance around young people and mental health separately. So to bash those two things together just feels like a double whammy, and just feels all the more unfair. Just feels, ugh, that's so gross. 30%.
Yeah, it's really sad. It's one thing, society not catching up on the stigma busting, but the fact that science is behind.
It would save lives. It would save so, so many lives.
Mm. So I just wanted to also pick up on what you said there with talking to parents, and that's a really big part of growing up, is
sure.
opening up this dialogue where you move from a place of being the child to then supporting each other more equally.
Yeah.
When you both become adults, trying your best to not have parents feel guilty about what you're going through.
Sure.
Because the guilt isn't helpful.
No.
My experience of that sort of guilt means that parents will push things away. They won't talk about things because they're painful, but actually talking about them without judgment and without blame is important healing.
Yeah.
And helps you understand each other.
For sure. Really does. Your parents are Irish though, so there's that guilt there. Just anyway, it's like Catholic guilt. Like, we don't talk about things. We don't, you know, we're guilty in that internalized religion way. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, you guys are Catholic, aren't you?
So my mum is Catholic, my dad is Protestant.
Okay, maybe this bit gets cut.
But without getting too much into religion, that is something quite common in Christianity, that bottling things up and feeling bad about them is a coping mechanism.
Oof.
And as we know, that's not a very helpful coping mechanism
with mental
health. So there are ways to navigate feelings of guilt and your opinions on sin without it being a detriment to your mental health.
Sure.
And I would encourage people to go through that process and speak to whatever faith leader they needed to, because they're people too.
Absolutely.
They have insight into the ups and downs. And so we will move right along to the episode itself. You'll hear more from us again in a few moments, but first, this week's Audible recommendation. I'm recommending Is It Just Me by Miranda Hart. If you've ever watched Miranda Hart do a comedy set or watched her TV programme on BBC, you'll know how incredibly funny she is with her unique brand of awkward humour. And her audiobook is no different. I love it. It's honestly, I've never laughed as much to a book. She does funny voices and impressions of people she grew up with. It mixes her life story with plenty of funny anecdotes about all the times she's fallen over that really make me feel like a far less awkward human. If this book sounds interesting, you can try your first book for free with Audible by following our link, bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details are in the description.
Hey, so my name's Annie Harris. Growing up absolutely was hell for me. I think I really started suffering massively when I was 14. It's such a formative age anyway, but my parents split up when I was 14 and I just was so unhappy. I was a really miserable teenager. I know that I had fibromyalgia and depression and I had anxiety, but I think also had to deal with all of these transitions, and I found out that transitions and I don't suit each other very well. I find that I struggle a lot with change, is the point that I was trying to make. I feel like for somebody already suffering with health problems, the changing of puberty and early adulthood on top of that is just super cruel. It feels awful, you know? It just feels like a double-decker shit sandwich, if you'll pardon the expression.
Okay, so was there a initial time when a lot of these things started? Was there like a first transition?
I remember when I was a kid, I definitely had undiagnosed OCD, for sure, looking back. And the first memories I have of that are when I was about 7 or 8. And that's actually, funnily enough, when we moved house. We moved from the house that I was not born in, but the house that my first house that my parents owned when I was born, to the house that we then lived in until my late teens. We moved there when I was about 7. So there was a big change around there. We moved from one end of town to another, left all my friends behind on one end of town, stayed at the same school. Yeah, I've never put that link together before, actually, so that's quite eye-opening. And, yeah, my parents divorced when I was 14. My dad got remarried when I was 15 to the woman he'd been seeing while still married to my mum, I think. You know, it's like, come on, Dad, we're not idiots. Pretty obvious.
But, see, now you can look back on something like that with more clarity. So at the time, what was that like? What was going on with your parents?
I just felt like everything was so unfair, you know? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who've got divorced parents, parents who have separated, parents who've never really been together, you know? And I had no clarity on it. I had no perspective. I didn't have the viewpoint that I have on it today with the experience and the wisdom that I have, you know, 15 years later. Mm-hmm. How old am I now? 14 years later. So, you know, it was horrible. It was like being stuck in this cloud, and it just felt like all these things just kept piling on top of one another, and I just couldn't see a way to get through or around them.
And at the time, how did all of this change your relationship with your parents? Because I think that's one of the things that is so difficult when kids go through divorce, is that their main support system is becoming fractured.
And yeah, for sure.
It can leave them not knowing where to turn for the support.
Well, my parents aren't great at emotional support anyway. They're great at supporting in other ways, but they're not the people I go to now for emotional support, certainly. My mum and I and my brother, we stayed in the same house and my dad moved out, and my dad my dad and I haven't spoken properly in like 2.5 years. So kind of gives you an idea of how the relationship started to develop after that. My mum had her own mental health problems of her own and was sort of in deep, deep denial, I suppose. And she even still is to this day. Like, when I mentioned this time, she's like, oh, I don't really remember that. I'm like, Yeah, so my mum and I, we got closer, and then we argued, and we didn't get closer, and then we got closer again, and then we fell out. Like, my mum and I have always had a very up and down relationship. I mean, it's always been civil, I'd say, at the very least, but we go through phases of being close and not close, and I'm okay with that. But my dad and I, as I say, we haven't spoken in a long time. And I'm sure, again, there's lots of people out there who can relate to that, people who don't have great relationships with their parents. And that's just something that comes with the transition of growing up, I think. We realize that our parents are our people. And if we weren't related to them, then would we be friends with them? Like, would we put ourselves in the same room as them if we weren't related by blood? Probably not.
I think your relationship with your parents changes several times through your life. For me, I feel like the first one is when you stop being so dependent on them for your basic needs. So sure. When you're old enough to look after yourself to a certain extent, and you can make, you know, your own toast if you want to.
Yeah, a bit of pasta.
as these things start to come, then you're not as reliant on your parents in an immediate way.
Sure.
And then it starts being more to do with you're reliant on them for the support, for the home, for the advice, these kind of things, but it's not so much the basic needs you're there for. And I think from that point on, your relationship starts changing, because what you were saying about would you necessarily be friends with them? Well, unless you have a load of maybe your parents' friends or like aunts and uncles around when you're growing up, there aren't really any people of the same age gap that you're around other than in professional settings, like they're your teacher or they work at your local corner shop. There's no one else that's in your home and interacting with you that regularly. And so it makes sense that as you start to mature and think more as an independent person, those that you relate to are increasingly the kids at school as opposed to the parents at home.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And also, like, the guilt surrounding that is very real. You know, I feel incredibly guilty sometimes that my parents and I aren't as close as I'm sure they'd like us to be. But it feels like forcing chemistry that's not there. And that's not fair on anyone.
Well, that's it, because I think the way society looks on parenting is in a way where there's certain rules that shouldn't be broken. Like, the parents should be staying together. The child should maintain a healthy relationship with both parents. But actually, for so many families, that's not the case. And nowadays, at least for the UK, I don't know so much for other countries, more marriages end in divorce. So those kind of expectations aren't realistic with how the world works right now. But I know enough people in my life that do have very difficult relationships with their parents, some of whom have had to separate themselves from their parents because of how toxic that relationship is. And whilst that's never ideal, sometimes you have to. For some people, the separation is the safest way to not hurt either of you. As you grew up then, what happened with...
Yeah, I lived with my mum after my dad got remarried. My parents sold their house and my mum bought a smaller house at the back at the other end of town where we'd originally lived. So we moved back down there. And that was when I was about 15, 16, I think I was, when we moved in there. Again, transitions, they really fuck with me. I remember that being a time of real just lowness and unhappiness and just being miserable. But I mean, a lot of change was happening. And also I was doing my GCSEs or my A-levels or whatever I was, you know, when you're 16, you're finishing your GCSEs, right? So it was a really big time and really formative time as well. Like, I think it's almost cruel to the point that, like, a lot of change happens in such formative years. I'm like, could we have, like, puberty and other stuff happen at different times, you know, so we
can
sort of deal with them?
Yeah, could we maybe be doing our GCSEs when we're not pumped full of hormones?
Yeah, that would be really great. Or, like, yeah, That works perfectly well. Or like sometimes people prefer to have like the pain all in one go, or sometimes people like the pain to be spread out. I mean, if it was puberty then GCSEs, it would be like, oh, when is this gonna end, you know? But actually no, I think I'd prefer to have it all in one go. Just get it over and done with. Get it out of the way. And then we can enjoy a happy adulthood. Ha 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 ha. She laughs hysterically and falls off her chair. My goodness.
So you mentioned previously that you had undiagnosed OCD. So what kind of symptoms were you noticing, and from what age did those start?
I would say probably about 7 or 8, I started having really intrusive thoughts. Like, if I don't do this in a certain way, then my family will die. I remember it being like as vivid and as explicit as that. You know, like, if I don't get to that lamppost before that person walking ahead of me, then my mum will die. Or if I don't organize my pens and they don't stay touching the side of the drawer at school in a certain way, then my brother will die. Like, it was cruel and unrelenting shit. And I remember, I think I mentioned this in my fibromyalgia episode, actually, but I remember like mentioning this to my mum, and she was like, ha ha ha, what silly brain thoughts you're having. And that was pretty much the end of our discussion about me having intrusive and very cruel thoughts.
However, at the time, they were really real for you.
Yeah, and really severe. Like, as I reflect on them now, I'm like, God, if an 8-year-old came to me and said that, I'd be like, fuck, like, that's hefty for an 8-year-old kid. Like, what have you been through?
But that one, from my understanding of OCD, is quite common to fixate on the death of a close family member, because your mind is going to the worst possible place. Mm-hmm. And so really, from a young age, parents and siblings, they're your main contact. And they're, in many ways with parents, they're the ones that show you the world when you don't understand it. They put boundaries in place to keep you safe, and they answer all your silly questions when you ask them why 15 times.
Yeah.
And so really, they're, to a large extent, the way you interpret the world from a young age. And I think even kids can tell how reliant they are, and tell how badly off they'd be without having a parent there.
Sure. Well, we can prove that by things like separation anxiety. I think it's most common in sort of toddler, I think the 2s, maybe 2s and 3s. But like, I mean, it happens to anybody. I get separation anxiety even now, but like, obviously not for my parents anymore.
Whilst I'm not a parent myself, I do have a cat. That means the world
to me.
You're a
cat parent.
but there are certain parallels. You know, she's still a mammal. And so she gets upset when she doesn't see me for a whole day, and then I come back and she's excited to see me, and then she just goes to sleep. But that's often that's all it is just having the support system there. Certainly a lot more when she was a kitten, she would run around and play around the flat and then come back to me to refer to me and check in that all was well, and then she'd run off again. But kids do that. You can see toddlers do that. They run away and then they need to check back in with the parents.
Yeah, check that they're still there, or the parents following them, or they're still on the bench at the park or whatever.
Right, so it is very much a reassurance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that carries on much later than perhaps we even realise at the time, that you still can feel weird not having a parent there, you know, if you're home alone. It's still odd, even when you're in your late teens.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, for sure. I remember when I was maybe sort of in my later teens, or even like, when I went to university, I got horribly homesick my first few months at university. I remember calling my dad in tears, like, just because, and the only reason I had to explain my tears is that I was homesick. And that was so unlike me as a teenager, because I'd always been such an independent child and an independent teen. But I remember just feeling awful, and I just called my dad, and he was like, you okay? And you're trying to pretend that everything's all right, and then suddenly it's, no, I'm not. What do you think's the matter? I think I'm just really homesick. Well, do you want me to come and get you? Yes, please. You know, and it was, I grew up in South Wales, and I went to university, my first year of university, actually, I was based in Reading. So it was like a 2.5-hour drive from my dad, but he was like, do you want me to come and get you? I was like, yep, absolutely. Like, I'm not arguing with that at all. Normally I'd have been like, no, it's okay, I'll get the train in the morning or whatever. But I was like, yep, you need to come and get me now. And then, you know, I was home in the bosom of my mother's house by midnight. But it was so unusual for that to happen to me. You know, I'd always been so independent. And I think I'd always had, I'm an independent adult, sort of emotionally. I don't know if that's because I'm naturally independent or maybe because I had independence sort of thrust upon me by going through things like divorce and, you know, threatened homelessness when I was in my late teens. I think a lot of maturity or premature maturity gets sort of thrust upon you when things like that happen at an early age. That's something that we should talk about as well, is like how that almost robs people of the chance to be innocent and the chance to be unspoiled by life.
Well, that's it. Remember earlier we spoke about these kind of supposedly unbreakable rules of you've got to stay close to your parents mm-hmm. have to stay together, and so frequently mm-hmm. these rules actually are broken. And mm-hmm. that's like another one, is that people are so passionate about children need to have a childhood. You can't mm-hmm. let them grow up too fast. But actually, mm-hmm. when you get older, that's sort of natural part of becoming an adult, is becoming mm-hmm. nearer to the parent figure. You sure. become more like them in many ways that can push you further away in your relationship, because we don't always get on with what is similar to us. But mm-hmm. definitely for those of us who have traumatic events growing up or lose a parent young and things like this, it's you often do find yourself stepping up and taking part of the parental role.
Sure.
To fill that gap.
Mm. Or even just the sort of the emotional parenting, you know? I think my mum really suffered when I was a kid. I know she would argue me down to the death if she ever heard this podcast, not that I ever think that she would. But she really suffered. I remember her suffering. And I remember her suffering even more when I was a teenager. And that meant that I did feel vastly unsupported emotionally as a teenager. And I think the thing, I'm not cross with the fact that my mother had mental health problems, because I would never be angry at someone for having a mental health problem. But I think the thing that I still, that's no secondary support, you know, when my parents got divorced, they told us and I left the house and I hung out with my friends for a bit and just cried and sulked and screamed about how it was so unfair. And then when I came home for dinner that night, my mum literally just like slapped a leaflet on the table in front of me. And that was like kind of the last time we ever really spoke about it.
And that
as a
was
family.
The conversation was a leaflet.
Oh, yeah. A leaflet. Yeah. That she'd gotten from, I mean, at least she did that. But I mean, like that was really it. And then from there on out, if I had any problem, it was like, well, I can't help you because I'm suffering. And I'm like, well, I'm suffering too. We're all suffering here. And that's the thing I can't really just accept.
I understand that. And with that situation where you were given a leaflet rather than really having a conversation, did you find that then their divorce became like a taboo subject that you couldn't bring up?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because I think that's another example of how people can become the parent when they're very young. It's you start mm-hmm. then filtering what you say so as not to upset the other person.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something that I've experienced quite a lot. And despite the podcast I do now, and despite my parents coming from a medical background, growing up, mental health was something that just wasn't discussed. And that might partly be a cultural thing. Certain mental illnesses are very common in Ireland, but it's not in common to talk about them. There's very much a kind of that man up culture seems to apply to everyone irrespective of gender.
Sure.
And so it's something that as I grew older, there were things like that and other topics which I learned to filter, because I knew that it would upset them to talk about.
Sure.
And there were certain conflicts that we didn't have as a way to protect them and as a way to protect me and our relationship. And that, I think when you start thinking like that, that's when you move into almost feeling like the parent. I certainly felt like that a lot.
Even now when I go home to visit my family, we still don't say things like depression and anxiety. My mum says, I'm feeling blue. My brother is struggling. We don't say the words. We don't put a name to them, which I think is super important. It's like saying Voldemort, right? It's like saying he who must not be named only adds to the fear. Let's call it what it is. Let's call it Voldemort. Let's call it depression. Let's call it anxiety.
I totally agree. And I think that particularly is common with parental situations, because it's not that you are someone that wouldn't be easy to talk to about this kind of stuff. It's a big part of your work. It's, I think, this inherent idea of blame that parents don't really want to necessarily dwell on the mental illness of a child, because they see that as somehow being their fault.
Yeah, my mum definitely does. Like, she's always, whenever we have a discussion about mental health, and I still think that she said to me recently that she was confused about my health, despite me being abundantly clear about it on sort of numerous platforms and in person. I don't know whether that's because she's getting old and her memory's failing, or whether she genuinely just denies that anything's going on. Bless her. If you are listening, Mum, then shit. I doubt that she will. She definitely feels responsible, I think, for everything. She gets very upset. Very, very upset. And it's like, well, why are you? I'm not getting upset. Why are you getting upset? You know? And I mean, I'm not trying to take away her experience. I'm not trying to say that she shouldn't be upset. But I think that whenever I discuss any sort of mental health situation with her, or physical health, you know, I have fibromyalgia as well, it always ends up with me comforting her, you know? And I'm like, sometimes I just kind of need a bit of comfort here. And I'm not getting that from you. And I've just very much learned over the course of my adolescence and early adulthood that I don't get emotional support from my mum. But luckily for me, you know, friends are the family that we choose. And now I have a really robust support network where I live in Brighton. Mm. So, but I haven't always had that. Only up until very recently have I been able to say that I've got really great friends down here and across the country. But I am very grateful. I am very lucky. And I think that's a huge part of growing up as well, is making your own family for yourself. I'm sure that you can relate to that.
Yeah, definitely. And just one thing I'd want to add on this idea of parents and to what extent they are a factor in mental health. They absolutely can be. However, the important thing to note in any of these situations is there's very rarely just one cause.
You know, true. Yes.
Wouldn't it be sweet if mental health was that simple, where it was just one cause? Because then you could just be like, okay, well, I won't see that parent and then I'll be fine. No, it's not as simple as that.
Yeah, it's sweet that they think that they're the center of our universe, but sorry, guys.
I want to come back to something about parents a little bit further into the episode, but before we get into that, I think what's important to discuss as well is how puberty is such a massive factor. I particularly feel like nowadays, with all the airbrushing, with this idea of perfectionism so often being put on our physical, that it's not enough to be a boss in your career. You also need to look flawless, which isn't reality. But that's something we can both relate on. Aren't we rush around during our day? It would be completely unachievable for us to always look flawless. That's one of the reasons I actually quite like modelling, because for me, it's kind of like playing pretend. I get to go along, and when I'm, let's say I'm modelling in the afternoon, I clear the whole morning because I know the importance of like beauty sleep. So I'll, you know, I'll have a lie in and I'll make sure I have a healthy meal and that I just do all these little things that make me feel and look my best, and feel as confident as I can as well and as grounded. And so I like doing that because it's an illusion. Then I get to go along and pretend like I do nothing all day, that I just wait for modelling work. And that's not my reality at all. Most of the time I look pretty haggard, but sometimes it can be fun to play into that fantasy. And that's all it is. And so that's definitely a big factor in how kids are growing up nowadays, because puberty can be bad enough without your role model being Kim K and being like, my ass doesn't look like hers. No one's ass looks like hers, not even hers. Okay, let's get that clear now.
Yeah, let's just spill the tea all over this thing. I think I was going to say that you and I didn't grow up with like Instagram when we were at high school. You know, we grew up with like magazines and TV shows and pop stars and music videos. We didn't grow up with the internet and social media at the height that it is today. But even then, it was hard enough. Like, we had the comparison of, things like magazines or seeing people on the TV or in music videos. And I think that social media is hard enough to deal with at 28 with my fully formed adult brain that no longer has every hormone possibly imaginable surging around it at any given time. And like suddenly my body just changes shape overnight and like hair's sprouting from all these random different places. And suddenly my voice is doing funny things. You know, I can't imagine what it's like to deal with puberty and social media at its peak at the same time. It must be an absolute nightmare. I teach a lot of teenagers day to day, like 3 or 4 days a week. I'm in classrooms with teenagers. And sometimes I'm like, God, these kids are an absolute nightmare. And then sometimes I think, Annie, take a step back and realize what these guys are up against right now. Like, they're up against 10 times more pressure from social media that you were up against, you know, 100 times more. Obviously, I'm speculating on the actual figure, but I can't imagine what it must be like. When I was growing up in the mid-90s, early 2000s, all the rage was to be like super flat-chested and have no hips. And then suddenly I had like double D boobs overnight and like these massive Welsh country girl farm-bearing, you know, like child-rearing hips on me. So even then I was like, oh, damn. But that was just because that was the trend of the time, was to be like Kate Moss, you know, like ironing board straight up and down. Or like Hannah from S Club 7, like super sporty. Scary Spice, Sporty Spice, like they were the gorgeous women. But nowadays, like I had an hourglass figure by the time I was 13, and these huge thick eyebrows that are like thick with 2 C's. Like today I would have been like hot property, but growing up in like the late 90s, early 2000s, I was like too curvy and had these big thick eyebrows that, you know, who's laughing now? Girls who used to overpluck their eyebrows to these little like worm things. Now I've got these gorgeous thick natural eyebrows that they're all like penciling in for hours, and I'm like, ha ha ha, you used to pick on me for my big thick eyebrows, but now I have to do nothing to them. Right. So that's a real smug moment for Annie Harris right there. Anyway, I'm getting off topic.
No, I absolutely agree with all of that. And what I would add to it is, like you say, these things are so changeable. And so you're setting yourself up for failure if you're going to try and follow any trends. And that's it, that not only do we always have these role models and these changing beauty standards, now the difference is with the online world, they're not in a magazine, they're in your pocket.
Yeah.
Every time you open your phone, you can go to Instagram and you can see someone like Nicki Minaj. And if I love her, but if you're going through puberty, it may be easy to look at someone like her and be like, oh, that's what I want to look like. That's aspirational. But to be clear, a surgeon, or most likely multiple surgeons, had far more factor in her shape than puberty did.
Right.
But that's the world we're living in. And then the other thing important to touch on as well with puberty is how the hormones can influence your mental health as well. When you've got all these hormonal changes, when you've got these mood swings, because I can speak for myself in saying that what I did have was I was a lot grumpier. My fuse was a lot shorter.
And oh, yeah.
So the fact that I was already experiencing depression symptoms pre being a teenager, and then when my hormones kick in, it takes place in this way where I'm more grumpy than normal, I'm more impatient than normal. That's not a good factor to put in with depression.
Agreed.
And that definitely contributed to negative feelings about the world and about myself that I had to battle with. Do you have any kind of similar experience that you can
think back on? Yeah, I mean, I guess I always had my mental health symptoms dismissed as being a teenager.
And we've heard from a few guests that have had that.
Yeah, a really troubling amount of symptoms were just, oh, it's just Annie being a moody teenager, or just, oh, it's just Annie being dramatic because she does drama at school. That was like one of my least favorite things ever, because drama and music were the only things that really sort of made me feel like I was worth something as a teenager, something that made me feel like I was good at something. And it was just belittled all the time. There was never any consideration for the fact that your teenager might actually be in a considerable amount of distress. It was just, oh, Annie does drama, so that means that she's dramatic. You know, I know my parents had their own shit going on, but at the same time, I think that being a parent is such a massive responsibility, and I don't think you should enter it lightly. And I know it's a really, it's getting less common these days for people to enter parenthood lightly. We could talk about this forever. Like, we need a special parenting episode, I think.
I think that's what I'm learning. You have a lot to say on this.
Oh my God, yeah.
One thing to bring it back slightly to schools, obviously listeners know how passionate we are about mental health education. And it's something I'm thinking about talking to you now, how, again, it's an example of how there's not that parity with mental and physical health. Because I remember I had good sex ed when I was at school, yet there was still that divide. So the physical stuff we had diagrams for, and we were taught through different sort of stages of our body's development. And there was a time when we were split, so we'd have the specific stuff for our gender taught to us as well. And that stuff was really clear on the physical side and was really quite scientific. And then when it came to things like your mood swings, it was, oh, you may experience that, moving on. There was no, here's what you should do about it. In the same way we had things like, as your body develops, it's a good idea for you to spend time, get familiar with yourself, stand over a mirror, do whatever you need to do, because you're going to go through a lot of changes, and it's a good idea for you to keep abreast of them, pardon the pun.
Sure.
And so there wasn't that equivalent with mood swings. It was, oh, you're going to get mood swings, bear that in mind. There wasn't any kind of coping mechanisms. Yeah. There wasn't any, oh, and it could also influence your mental health because, or if you have a pre-existing mental illness, it might get worse.
Do you think that's down to a lack of understanding about mental health in general?
I wonder if it's possibly understanding, but also respect, that it's not always seen as a serious, that, oh, these things that happen to your body, they're real because we can point at them.
Yeah, but I think that the scientific community now, at least 10 years, 15 years on, agrees that it happens and that it exists.
Absolutely, that's true. So there definitely is progress being made. But I think when we talk about growing up being a factor in mental health, puberty is definitely a big part of that story, yet it's not a narrative I ever experienced growing up. It's something that I've had to look back on and pick up on myself. And so one thing I wanted to pick up on again with what we've been talking about with parenting is that there is this very real situation of parents feeling that their kids are growing up too fast. And there does seem to be this kind of bias towards them wanting to keep you young and protected. And I can certainly understand those kind of instincts. I sort of make a joke to people sometimes when they say to me, oh, you know, I dyed my hair, my parents weren't keen on it. And I'll say, well, your parents don't want you to do anything that makes you look less like you were as a child.
Yeah, right.
It's trying to hold on to you. And that's a perfectly understandable instinct. But I think sometimes what can happen in that situation is that as we grow up and we become independent adults, there can be this sort of gap where we go through these changes so quickly from about 15 onwards, when puberty is really setting in, when we're going into our exams, there's all these things happening. And it can take up until the mid or late 20s for the parents to catch up on this is where you are now.
Uh-huh.
And to start seeing you as an adult and not a 15-year-old.
Yeah, I really relate to that super heavily. I'm glad that we touched on the topic of early adulthood, or adulting, as I like to call it. Like, I think the start of my adulting really came about when my parents split up. Suddenly I was just thrust into this world of like, now you need to choose your GCSEs because they're going to determine what you do for your job for the rest of your life. Oh wait, now you need to suddenly choose a college. Now you need to learn how to, I don't know, rent a house and go through all that contracting stuff, get a bank account, worrying about like overdrafts. How often do I need to do the food shopping? I need to go to the gym. I need to pay my electricity bill. What the fuck is council tax? When are they coming to collect my bins? What is this? You know, adulting, I think, was the hardest part for me. I think the transition from university into postgraduate life was the hardest by a country mile. I thought I had it rough when my parents got divorced. That's sweet. That's cute. Like, it was so much more of a roller coaster ride coming out of university. Fuck, what a nightmare that was.
It's funny, isn't it, though, that we have this experience growing up where we come across new things and new challenges. Mm-hmm. And even you see that a lot in academia. I remember when I was doing my A-levels and there'd be the kids worrying about their GCSEs, and you'd think, you don't know the half of it.
Yeah,
don't worry about these ones. Wait till you get the A-levels. But that is very much what growing up is that you face more and more challenges, and as you grow up you're less and less protected from adulting, as you say. So mm-hmm. you have more of these challenges come your way, yet there's that disparity where as a kid you think, oh, when I'm an adult I'm gonna have so much freedom, I'm gonna do whatever I want, I'm gonna be an astronaut, all of this. And so there is that realization as you get closer to adulthood, you learn more of what it really is, and the sheen goes off it, and that can be quite upsetting.
Sure, it really can. It can be a real shock, I think. The as you say, the curtain is drawn away, like in The Wizard of Oz, and it's just a small bald man behind the curtain. The illusion is shattered of this amazing life where you get to eat ice cream for breakfast and you get to sleep in as long as you want, when in actual fact you have to spend your money on things like bin bags and bleach. I think that's the real definition of adulting, is buying things with your money that you just really don't want to have to buy. Like, why isn't somebody else buying this for me? Why do I have to buy toilet cleaner with the money that I've earned going to work every day? This sucks.
For sure. You get to this point as well, don't you, where you become your own parent, because you're buying all the boring parent stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't have a family member telling you off for eating ice cream for breakfast. You just tell yourself off.
Yeah, or your heartburn tells you off, because once you hit 25, heartburn is really real. Like, that struggle is severely real.
In summary,
Growing up sucks.
But growing up can be such a massive factor in your mental health. Not only how it is day to day, but also how it develops. When so many young people are diagnosed young, and increasingly so, as mental health support gets better, so do kids get diagnosed younger. Which can be a bit of a double-ended blade.
Double-edged sword.
There's the saying. There it is. Is there anything you want to finish up by saying? Any last-minute insights?
No, because I don't have any. And whenever you ask me this and I don't have any amazingly wisdomful, wise insights, it makes me feel like a total idiot. So never ask me that question again. Just assume I'm an idiot and move on. Wrap it up.
Well, okay, somebody needs to go listen to our self-love episode.
Okay.
And so on that note, we'll finish up there. Annie, would you mind reminding the people where they can find you online?
For sure. You could find me on Twitter at Real Annie Harris.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Hey there, friend. If you enjoyed listening to this episode of Mental Podcast, then make sure you head over to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher to leave us a lovely, glittering 5-star review. However, if you didn't enjoy listening to this podcast, then shh.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.